Hi, this is Corey Olson, the Tolkien Professor, and you're listening to the Fairy and Fantasy class.
Welcome to Fairy and Fantasy, Episode 31. This time, Professor Olson gives us a little more of C.S. Lewis's The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and begins with Peter Beagle's The Last Unicorn, Chapters 1 through 4.
Okay, I want to start off with two very quick final notes about The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. I felt like we kind of just ended right in the middle of something last time, and I wanted to just sort of tidy that up a tiny bit, though I don't want to steal too much time away from Peter Beagle. One last comment on the deep magic and the deeper magic, which is where we ended last time. I think there are several things that are interesting about this. I mean, I think the larger thing we can see operating here, the way this seems to be working in this story, is that this is pointing to a kind of moral framework, you know, a kind of spiritual law or moral law that the witch and Aslan are both aware of. And the patterns between the two of them seem relatively clear and also relatively familiar, certainly from the perspective of Christian theology. The deep magic from the dawn of time points to crime and punishment, points to sin and the consequence of sin, that when evil is done, then there are consequences to that. And death is the rightful consequence of that. But then the deeper magic from before the dawn of time, the moral law which precedes that law of justice, is the law of grace, that is, that redemption. The groundwork of redemption is laid prior even to the establishment of the moral law of justice. And I think the way that he does that is very interesting, and I think the way that he weighs it out works very well. One thing that I find most interesting about it, and we're not going to have a whole lot of time to talk about it, but I just thought I would note that I think anyway it's interesting, is basically his use of the word magic to characterize this. One question which in some ways, from some angles we've talked about a tiny bit, is, you know, that Narnia is a magical kingdom. In what sense is it a magical kingdom exactly? Some magic seems to happen there. Some people do magic, but it's not just like a place where people cast spells. The witch is the only one that we really see performing what is obviously magic. Aslan's magic works differently. Father Christmas's magic works differently. And here we see the deep magic and the deeper magic, the foundational magical principles of Narnia, turn out to be something which look like and sound like moral laws. And I think that connection between magic and that larger moral and spiritual framework is kind of interesting. Matt?
I was going to say we could say it's a magical kingdom in the sense that magic is actually part of its foundational laws. Physics is part of our foundational laws.
Yeah.
It's a common thing.
Yeah, I mean, magic is involved in the sense that there are creatures which are called magical creatures. I mean, like fauns and dryads are magical creatures, and they live there, and so therefore it's a magical kingdom. I think the sort of how foundational that is. But again, when you look at in many ways, the similarity, again, especially from a Christian theological standpoint, between the deep magic and the deeper magic, and the Christian concept of, in fact, the moral framework that underlies our world, then the characterization of that as magic, I think, it just becomes interesting, almost an alternative way of looking at what kind of amounts to a similar thing.
Jordan? If I could draw on previous stories for a moment, I'm not sure that, well, obviously Lewis thinks magic is the right term, but for what applies here, but in terms of what's going on, which applies to this kind of principle in general, I'm not sure it is, because magic often is something that's worked or, you know, an effect, whereas we sort of air and Narnia we were discussing.
Yeah.
It seems to be more of a very facet of nature. And I can't remember if enchantment does Tolkien apply here, but it seems like that there's something similar to another term that implies the difference between, like, the work of magic and the implement of reality. Clearly he's, you know, placing effects on the world and the universe as he created or made or whatever he does. I have read the rest of the books, so... But... I think things like the inherent, you know, grounding of Narnia in madness made me to get a different term for that than that which worked, because I think there's a difference between the very aura and presence of the wondrous and the marvelous versus the effects of someone's will.
Yeah, no, I agree. And as is fairly typical of the difference in interest and temper between Lewis and Tolkien, Tolkien was really interested in these definitions and really, at various points, both in his essays and in his stories themselves, puts pressure on this. What exactly is magic? What things do people call magic? What are they right to call magic? What should be considered something else? And Lewis's use of the term here is clearly much broader brush and less precisely meant and precisely defined than Tolkien would have defined it, certainly. But I agree, it's hard. I had to forcibly restrain myself from quoting what Galadriel says to Sam Gamgee in The Fellowship of the Ring when I was talking about the White Witch's magic there. But I did. So that was good. That is a very natural sort of thing to be thinking about, I think. The second thing that I wanted to touch on, or just sort of wave at as we leave Lewis behind, is a thing that I waved at briefly once before, but I wanted to at least make a second wave, and that is the role of the human children in this magical kingdom. They are on the one hand aliens, but certainly if we think back in contrast to Smith and Smith's relationship with the fairy world, it is very different from the relationship between the Pevensies and the magical world that they find themselves in. Smith presumed upon the passport that he was given. He's given a passport into fairy, and he presumes that this gives him certain rights to explore and to find things and to go wherever he wants, and finds in the end that he was transgressing, which of course he had hints of prior from the whole birch tree incident and then of course his rebuke by the fairy queen. With Narnia, things are quite different. There is a sense from the beginning that they have a place here, that this is in a sense their place, and they are not merely visitors who are being graciously tolerated. We can see this in the legends about them, and certainly once we hear the prophecies, we see that they are in fact destined not only to arrive at this place, not only to be given a kind of passport, but to live here and to rule here, at least for a time, and of course really quite a long time, in the Narnian time frame. So not only do they have a role, but their role is sovereignty. They are appointed. The sons of Adam and daughters of Eve are appointed to rule over this kingdom. And we will find that this is something that persists through the rest of the series of Narnian books if we continue to read them. It's in, I think, and Kelly, you asked about this before, it's in Prince Caspian, when a character makes the comment that Narnia is never really right when there isn't a son of Adam or daughter of Eve ruling the country. So they have this, not only do they have a kind of right to be here far surpassing Smith's right to be in Faerie, but they have rulership, not ownership, but rulership there. And yet, at the same time, it's not like this is their place. It's not like they have left England behind and come to the place which has truly been their home all along. That's not the case. They return home to England, and England is their place. And their whole time in Narnia turns out just to be one visit to Narnia. We are told at the end that they will likely make another one, that they may yet get into Narnia again, though not by that door. But again, even that, it's like you may be allowed to go back and visit. So from the England standpoint, from the Terra Cognita standpoint, their time in Faerie is actually more fleeting and more inconsistent than Smith's. Smith at least gets a lifetime relationship of being able to go back and visit. They, on the one hand, live most of a lifetime in Narnia, but again, from the Terra Cognita standpoint, they make two of them are going to make two visits, two of them are going to make three visits. And that's it. all of which are going to take none of our time. So, and we'll find in the very end, that is in the last battle, of course, when Lewis sort of makes his final philosophical and theological grand gestures at the very end of the series. One of my favorite lines being Professor Kirk muttering about how this is all in Plato and what do they teach them in these schools. But anyway, that neither England nor Narnia are in fact their true homes. But anyway, I think that their relationship with this magical world, with this fairy realm that they enter, is interesting. I mean, it makes for an interesting comparison, I think, to compare the Pevensies in Narnia with Irene and her magical kingdom, both up and down, and Smith in Fairy. But anyway, okay. Peter Beagle. Let's do The Last Unicorn. The Last Unicorn is that we are now resuming a kind of chronological basis. The final two works we're going to be reading this semester are genuinely the most recently written ones. We begin, Peter Beagle is a kind of a transitional figure in some sense, that is transitional from the early days of 20th century fantasy, people like Lord Dunsany and Tolkien and Lewis, who were still really at least paving the path into the mainstream awareness of fantasy literature in the 20th century. Again, it's not like these people were inventing even Dunsany. It's not like they were inventing the fantasy genre. Certainly Lewis and Tolkien weren't. They were following in the footsteps of many, such as Lord Dunsany and George MacDonald before him. But Lewis and Tolkien certainly played an enormous role in bringing it into the awareness of many. Now we begin to get sort of the successors, Peter Beagle being one of the successors of those generations, and him being in this, I think, a very interesting kind of intermediary position. Not a bridge, that makes it sort of too grandiose, I think, but sort of responding to the Lewis and Tolkien generation, but yet not in the newer, younger generation of fantasy writers who grew up completely in the post-Lewis and Tolkien world. Largely following in the footsteps, especially of Tolkien. When Professor Michael Drought visited my Tolkien class last year, those of you who are in the class may remember him making reference to the fact that it seems like almost all modern fantasy writers have to write at least one complete Tolkien ripoff book and kind of get that out of their system before they can then go and do their own thing. It seems like almost obligatory. And there certainly is, it has been hard for modern fantasy writers, as I say, who have grown up in the post-Tolkien fantasy world, to completely get out from under his shadow, and there are many who never fully emerge from that shadow. Beagle wasn't there. You know, I mean, he's publishing The Last Unicorn is being published less than 15 years after the Lord of the Rings was published. So this is after. And working with sort of the popularity, the mainstream popularity that Tolkien has helped to win for fantasy, but yet not operating in a totally post Tolkien and Lewis paradigm as the later ones will be. Of course, our final book, Garth Nix's Sabriel, was written in the last decade, so that's sort of our one example of that sort of definitively. Sort of the recent generation of fantasy stuff. Now, what do you notice about Beagle? What struck you? I want to start with questions of complete vagueness. There are a bunch of things I'd like to talk about, but rather than just kind of dictating that, especially at this point in the semester, you know, we've been reading a lot of things. You know, we've been seeing a lot of trends and noticing a lot of stuff, and so I'd just be interested to hear what kind of struck you. Even if this doesn't have to be mine, you don't have to be like, and let me share with you the brilliant insight which occurred to me while I was reading this book. Any question that you had, a trend that you noticed, if you don't know what to say about it, just give us a topic to talk about. Kat, what did you notice?
He's really obsessed with the sea.
The sea, yes, the sea is gonna be, and that's gonna get worse, not better, over the course of the rest of this book. That is to say, I think that you're really picking up on an important motif here in this book. Where do we first hear of it? What's our first reference to the sea? Remember?
Description of the unicorn.
The description of the unicorn, her color, right?
She moved in the shadow towards the sea. There was a pale glow of sea foam.
Exactly. Well, it used to be the color of sea foam. Yes, now it's the color of what, like snow in the moonlight, right? Kudos, color description that doesn't tell us so much about color as about other things. Good. So, no, I think that's we're going to see the sea is going to be very important, certainly as we move towards the end of this book. So that's certainly a thing to notice, and we'll definitely come back to that. What is the connection between unicorns and the sea? We see that connection established on page one. What is Beagle suggesting by connecting unicorns to the sea as he does? So I think that's a great observation. Far too early for us to come to conclusions about that, but you know, we should definitely flag that. Yeah, Jordan.
I was discussing the book with Moda earlier, and she made a really interesting point that incidentally makes me want to punch one of the reviewers quoted. But
the puff things in the front.
She made the point that the unicorn is not remotely human, and that's a strength of the book, that she doesn't feel human when you read it. And then the reviewers of the class, she completely diagnosed as human. I'm like, you missed the point. But she also made the point that this makes the unicorn not relatable, but in the sense that we use the word, that it's still a great book, disproves a lot of, you know, common literary theory. You know, the unicorn is not relatable. She's a unicorn. You can't relate to being a unicorn because you don't know.
Right.
It's an agreement with you.
Oh, let's see that. Oh, yes, the real world one.
Here at the top, in Coolopsies.
She becomes briefly agonizing with you.
Well, she isn't.
Well,
kind of
maybe that's
ticked
about
her agony.
Yeah, I mean, I guess agonizingly in one sense. Sure. Yeah. Well, that, of course, certainly is another thing to pay attention to, which even in the first four chapters we're nudged towards, that is thinking about the relationship between humanity and unicornity.
Unicornification?
Well, no, because that would be the process of turning somebody into a unicorn. So, no, like, yeah.
Unicornity?
Unicornity. No. The unicornity! Yeah, exactly. So, thinking about, what it means to be a unicorn, what it means to be human, what are the relationships between those two things? Not just the relationships between unicorns and people, though that, of course, is one of the things which will certainly help us think about this. How do unicorns relate to people, and people relate to unicorns? Even some of the questions that she has in mind. Like, for instance, when the guy, the old fat guy who first sees her and tries to catch her with his belt, right? The question that she asks before she realizes that he doesn't even recognize that she's a unicorn, and she's like, "What are you hunting me for? What are you trying to gain here?" She doesn't understand, and that is, she has a sense, a conception of what is to be gained from hunting unicorns, and is wondering, like, "What paradigm do you fit in?" It's before she has her moment where she's like, "Holy crap, you don't even own a unicorn, do you?" That is, all of the paradigms that I had are kind of blown here. But that is, I mean, she asks that question, and I think it's therefore appropriate for us to ask that question. When Shmendrick, whose name I shall attempt to say with a straight face during the next four classes, Peter Beagle, I believe, chose the name to be comedic. I mean, it's not supposed to sound not silly. Shmendrick is a pretty, and that is how it is pronounced. For those of you who are like me, audiobook consumers, the only audio version of this that exists is read by Peter Beagle himself, so I can give authoritative pronunciations of these names. And there are actually several other things. For instance, in the encounter that she has with the butterfly, when the butterfly is doing his like jumbled together quotations of things, when Peter Beagle reads that, he sings the butterfly's lines. So the butterfly is definitely chanting and at times actually singing. I almost said melodically, but that's a strong word. Anyway, it's singing. So I think that there's there's some cool things to be gained from the audiobook version. When Schmendrick asks for his boon as his boon to be taken with her and to be able to accompany her on her journey, I think that's another moment where we can see this. Well, I don't know what. Anyway, this issue of being raised. That is, what do humans want from unicorns? What do unicorns want from humans? And he tells her the story of the unicorn that was turned into a human, and she thinks that was appalling. Right? Why did Nico the magician turn the, or Nico, I think it's Nico actually, turn the unicorn into a human? Do you remember, John? Yeah, it was, saved his life, right? The hunters were coming in with their bows, and he turned him into a handsome prince, and he lived happily ever after with the princess, and the unicorn's like, that's so sad. What a sad story. But of course, you see that, but it's just a joke, but you see the irony there, right? The story that Schmendrick tells is a fairy tale. That could totally be in line. And the unicorn turned into a handsome prince, and the two of them got married and lived happily ever after and had fine and noble offspring who, like, became a line of famous kings and whatever. Yeah. Hooray! Right?
Isn't
that offspring? No, they didn't have offspring. That's right. Anyway. Well, I'm trying to make it even happier. Whatever. So, the point is they were happy and it was good, sort of. But no. The unicorn's like, that's not a happy way. It doesn't sound like happy way ever after.
Well, she does have, in conjunction with that, she does have trouble even thinking about death. And I remember there's a really cool point, and, well, no, I think it's reading ahead, but, like, when she's in the cage and she's watching...
Yeah, no, the cage is in today's reading.
Yeah, L.A.
Yes.
And she's just absolutely horrified by the decay.
Yes.
In that final
cage. Her illusory experience of age... is an important moment for her. That's her first personal brush with mortality, with what it would be like to be like a human. I do think that this is definitely an interesting theme. Definitely something else to be watching as we come. Other things? Other themes we should hit on? Yeah, yeah.
It's sort of like Lewis in the sense that, well, I mean, I'm not completely sure where the mythologies are coming from, again, because I don't really know much about them, but like the mix of like creatures just sort of pulling from wherever.
Yeah, especially in Mommy Fortuna's Midnight Carnival.
Yeah.
Right. Now, that, of course... on the one hand, is a mishmash because it's fake, right? The Asgard serpent isn't really there. The spider isn't really Arachne. But the harpy's really there. And who's the harpy?
Selena?
Yes, yeah, Selena or Selino the harpy. Who is she?
Foundation's quiz. Some of you just read this last week.
Who is she? Where do we meet her? Peter Beagle is an excellent foundation reader. Remember the book?
She fought the other last the Sons of the North Wind. It mentions the very story in the book, actually.
She features in the story of the Argonauts. Though we most famously meet her in the Aeneid, She's the leader of the harpies who come down and foul the spangles. Yeah, that's her. She's much fiercer in this book. Though, I mean, who knows? Aeneas is pretty studly, so maybe she was just as fierce, but, you know, wasn't gonna try it on with Aeneas and his voice, whereas Mommy Fortuna, she's fine with that. Yeah, certainly, but Christine, getting back to your point, there is certainly, I think it's not exactly like Lewis in the sense of these actual elements being spliced together. I mean, the centerpiece, when we talk about the actual magical things in this story, the real kind of fairy, the actual fairy tale elements, as opposed to the illusory ones, you know, you've got the unicorn, of course, as the centerpiece. We do have, apparently, human magicians being able to... We've got the illusions of Mommy Fortuna, which do clearly have power. Shmendrick, who can do magic, not predictably and not well, but actual magic is performed by him. And then we have... the Red Bull.
Which makes me laugh every single time.
This, of course, predates by many decades... beverage. And you must simply suppress associations with the beverage. Yeah. But anyway, but you needn't necessarily suppress connections to the Black
Hole. Here we go again.
Come on now. I mean, I thought that was obvious. But anyway, we don't have to talk about that yet. But yeah, I mean, I do think so. In some ways, I think we can, it seems in some ways sort of a little more consistent in that way than Lewis's. But I think even just the fact, even thinking of it in terms of, as in Lewis, the relationship between the magical world and stories about the magical world, this is a work that is being built on the foundation of stories, some mythological stories and some fairy tales. We get references and reminders of fairy tale traditions in addition to mythological traditions like Celaeno, the harpy from especially the Aeneid, or Arachne. We also get, you know, not only the sort of pseudo fairy tale of the unicorn turned into a prince, but also the reference that the blue butterfly throws out to Rumpelstiltskin. You know who I am, and the butterfly says Rumpelstiltskin, right? I mean, again, just, there are a bunch of things like that, which just always kind of give us these little cues to remember. We are operating in a kind of fairy tale world. That those fairy tale stories are definitely sort of stories which inform this. And we hear some of these stories, some of the local stories. That is like the story of the hunter's grandmother who once met a unicorn. You know, these stories do kind of come through. And one of the things that we see is again the theme of what do people believe? What can people perceive? Right, and this especially in Mommy Fortuna's Midnight Carnival. Since I mentioned the butterfly, what did you make of the butterfly?
I felt like there were several important things mixed in with a whole bunch of nonsense meant to throw us.
Yep, it is. I mean, and it's clearly these few things which emerge, including, I mean, this is where the unicorn learns the crucial thing, right? This is where she first gets the information. She's worried that the unicorns are gone, that she is in fact the last unicorn. But this, she just begins worrying that when she overhears the hunter saying that you never see unicorns anymore. But as we see after that, she's debating with herself, well, maybe that just means that they don't see them, right? I'd know it, surely, if all the other unicorns are gone. But it turns out, actually, they are gone. And this is the first hint that we get of where they went and what happened to them. She talks about the red bull. Chased them all the way. The red bull came behind them. It's out of this what seems like static, what seems like nonsense. It is nonsense, but it's a particular kind of nonsense. It's not the nonsense that the butterfly says is not just random words. It's not just static. What is it? Surely, even if you couldn't make sense of it, you recognize some of the things that the butterfly says.
There are things that the butterfly has heard. So, like, we're almost looking to hear from the story. One that struck me was take the A train.
Take the A train, yeah.
And I got really confused because I'm like, what time period is this?
1968. Take the A train. Yeah. I am a roving gambler. Yeah. This song about Mary Jane. Most of these are songs. Snippets of songs of wildly different genres. Sometimes traditional rhymes. Sometimes comparatively contemporary songs. Take the A train. And they're all, and sometimes from advertising jingles and things. And they're all kind of garbled together, but it's almost all song. And then what emerges, you know, kind of, you say these are things that she's heard. Or he. Which gender is the butterfly?
It's a he.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, his voice.
Yeah. The other thing that I find really interesting that the butterfly says is the dream. That he had? Remember the dream that he had? Because he had a dream that he was crawling along the ground. Which, of course, he was. He was a caterpillar. So some of it is memory, it seems. But obviously, the butterfly is not very good at synthesizing experience. In a sense, in some ways, the butterfly seems almost the opposite of the unicorn. The first thing that the unicorn draws attention to when she meets the butterfly is how transitory the butterfly is. Asks him why he's out flying. They will take cold and die before his time. Wins his time almost immediately. He's not going to live very long. Very short lifespan. So you have, on the one hand, this immortal, unchanging being speaking to this extremely ephemeral little being, who has almost no, it seems, almost no synthetic powers. That is, he's been around for a little bit, and he's heard these things, and he repeats them, these songs, mostly. But it doesn't understand anything that it's saying. And the unicorn has this wider view. But the unicorn doesn't know anything. Because the unicorn hasn't heard anything in centuries. Because the unicorn has been completely isolated. So again, I think that the butterfly and unicorn are really kind of an interesting pairing there. And of course, it's the butterfly who gives this information to the unicorn. More on the Midnight Carnival. How does Mommy Fortuna's carnival work? She's got 9 cages, right? What's the general rule? How do the majority of Mommy Fortuna's exhibits work? Taylor?
She takes an animal that is vaguely similar to whatever mythological creature she's trying to show off. She does an illusion enchantment that makes everybody who sees it believe that it is that thing.
Okay. So it's illusion, and it is interesting that it is at least a little bit connected to reality. Right, we're going to make an illusion of Cerberus. But we're not going to make an illusion of Cerberus either, like out of thin air. It's not like an empty cage with an illusion of Cerberus in it. Nor is there like a bunny rabbit with an illusion of Cerberus. It's a dog. It's a real dog. And the manticore is a real lion. And the snake's a real snake. And Arachne's a real spider. So what is happening is she is taking real things. What's she doing exactly? Is she changing the things? What is she changing, you say?
The spectator's perception of the thing. So it's all based on belief, isn't it?
The magic seems to work as much on the people as on... It's not really magic that she's performing on. It's not, I'm going to take this dog, I'm going to cast a spell on this dog so that this dog looks like Cerberus. The dog's really there. And if you look through it, as Ashmendrick urges the unicorn to look through it, you can see the real bond still there. The dog hasn't changed. Its appearance hasn't changed. What changes is what the people see. And we can see her messing, you know, the sort of the closest description we get of her messing with people's perception and belief is the effect of her, that is Mommy Fortuna's performance as Ellie old age, upon the unicorn herself, right? Her own perceptions, even of herself and her own experience, are altered by the magic of Mommy Fortuna there. She hasn't cast a spell on the unicorn. She's not actually changed the unicorn. She changes how the unicorn sees and perceives even her own self there in that moment. So that does seem to be how these operate. But now there are several different kinds of really important exceptions to the rule of Mommy Fortuna's karma, right? That is, the rule is some kind of mundane but comparable animal which is being... And the spectator's perception of it is being altered so that it looks like this fantastic figure. But what are the exceptions? Aaron?
The harpy, the unicorn, and Ashmendrick.
Yeah, Ashmendrick is interesting. He's, of course, not on display, but he's part of the show. And he is... You know, everything that's an exception in a different way, which I think is really interesting. And we can kind of take them case by case. Ashmendrick is an exception. How? How is Ashmendrick unlike the rest of these? He is... There's some similarity, right? He's a... bungling guy who wants to be a magician and says he's a great magician, doesn't really seem to be a great magician. But again, like the animals, like the dog, like the lion, it's not, hey, I'm going to like just take some random dude and say, hey, you're a great magician, just and deceive the people with that. He's just like, you know, as the manticore is described, as it's a perfectly good lion, right? It's just not a manticore. So Ashmendrick is a... Well, he's not a perfectly good magician, but he is a kind of magician. But what's different? What else is different about him? He points to differences in perception and appearance, too. What's Ashmendrick's favorite phrase? What does he always say about himself? Huh? I am older than I seem. Right? I am older than I appear. Yeah. I'm older than I look. Because his face looks really young. So he is suggesting what you are seeing is just an appearance. He is Ashmendrick the magician, the last of the red hot swamis. Don't ask, I haven't the faintest idea what that means. Not even a vague clue as to what the last of the red hot swamis are. And frankly, I try not to speculate about it. But anyway, he's with him, he argues, or he claims at various points, that it's almost the opposite, right? You look at him and you perceive... Instead of looking at the lion and perceiving a manticore, you're looking at a manticore and perceiving a lion, right? You're looking at the great magician and you're only, you think that I'm Ashmendrick the bungler who looks really old, or looks really young and incompetent, but really, I'm older than I look. I am this great, but of course he doesn't himself really believe that either. Other exceptions. The harpy. Clear exception.
And dangerous.
Yeah.
Like all the creatures there, she's probably, as they keep saying, the worst one to have in a cage.
Yes. That was her first mistake, Ashmendrick says. Right? To try to actually keep the real harpy in a cage. The harpy is real. There is no illusion. When people look at the harpy, they are actually seeing the real harpy. She really is what everybody thinks she is. And in the end, she does what Shmendrick and the Unicorn believe she's really going to do, which is bust out and eat Mommy Fortuna and her lackey, who takes a long time to answer riddles. Other exceptions.
Well, I was going to point out the one thing that Hopi isn't is what Mommy Fortuna thinks she is, which is, you know, captive.
Yeah. But there you could say the difference is not even in the harpy, but in Mommy Fortuna's understanding of herself. She believes that she can hold her, and that if she gets out, she'll just capture her again. Not so, it turns out. Yeah.
I got the impression that she had this sense of that the harpy would at some point see her. Because when she talks to the harpy every day when she goes and checks on the lock, she says, not yet, not yet. And I took that to be that, like, not yet. I know you're eventually going to get out, but...
Yeah, I mean, she has that moment where she talks a good game. She's like, oh, yeah, if she gets out, I'll capture it again. But yeah, maybe she doesn't really herself entirely believe that. My favorite exception in Mommy Fortuna's carnival, the spider.
She believes in the illusion herself. So even when the carnival is falling apart around her, the spider is going to stay there and sort of maintain this, I guess, this sense of decorum, I suppose.
Yeah. And the last thing we hear from this carnival is the spider weeping. Love the spider. That is so cool. The unicorn, of course, is another exception, but also different. The unicorn, on the one hand, the unicorn seems like the harpy, right? That is, Mommy Fortuna has 9 exhibits, 2 of which are real and 7 of which are shams. But there's a difference between those two. Not just, like, the unicorn is nice and the harpy is not. But that is, in their existence as exhibits, what's the difference between them?
There's no spell on the harpy, right?
Yes, exactly. Although the unicorn, although she has what she said to me, she says, and look, here's the unicorn, and it is. She still has to do the illusion. Because when people look at it, they're just going to see a horse. The harpy has no illusion. They look at the harpy and they see a harpy. The unicorn, they're going to see a horse. Unless she makes the illusion of what is in fact the real. That's one of the most complicated moments, I think, certainly in the first quarter of this book. Where we have this kind of examination of the relationship between belief and fantasy, what the unicorns seem to represent to the humans, and why and the fact that the humans have such a an interesting and significant relationship with the unicorns, as one of the hunters says to the other hunter way back in the first pages. A line which kind of resonates through most of the rest of the book, I think. Would you call this age a good one for unicorns? The answer seems to be no. But of course, the follow-up is, has there ever been one that was? At least that's the question the unicorn asks herself. Anyhow, I gotta let you go. I didn't talk about one of the things I really wanted to talk about, which is Mommy Fortuna's song that she sings when she is in the form of Ellie, her 3 verses, which I think are really cool. Maybe next time.
That's all for this time. Next time is chapters 5-8 of The Last Unicorn by Peter S. Beagle. Thanks for listening, and Godspeed.